Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Smashbox TV's podcast 422.
Oh, yeah, 422. Darn it. I think I messed up the title. I'm going to have to go back and edit that.
We're getting there, folks. We're getting there.
I updated the name because we were in a hurry at the last minute here, and I forgot to update the number.
Well, either way, it's, I believe, 422.
It is 100% correct.
Tonight's very special guest who will be joining us in just a few moments, Stephen Dodge, or I don't even know if he's listed as the tournament director, but he's the overall event coordinator, we'll say, of the MVP Open at Maple Hill. I think he's passed off most of the real work to other more qualified people. But either way, he's in charge, and he gets all the glory, and rightfully so.
He was a dapper man this weekend. Every time I saw him, he was in a nice little suit jacket.
That's his
little
new,
being the key word.
That's his new shtick. That's really? All part of a new overall look and feel. When he picked me up back in May, I believe not only was he wearing a suit coat, but he was also wearing shorts and unmatched socks with it. So he's got this brand new look down. He's got a wife that likes to make sure that he's dressed and feels good.
From the waist up, at least.
Yes. I mean, that's his good side. Well, we can thank, the whole world can thank Jessie. And I mean, she's a professional career hairdresser and has added so much more flair and style and dapperness.
I was really hoping that he would just break out his old Star Trek uniform.
I know. I brought that up earlier today, that's what we've seen from him. So anyway,
I've got a picture somewhere of me and him.
I looked at my phone. I couldn't find it.
I know I have it.
So we're going to talk to Steve in just a few moments, and then we'll recap everything else that's been going on outside of the MVP Open at Maple Hill. Of course, we have the Disc Golf Pro Tour in its regular season, so to speak, and postseason. I don't know how we're using these phrases since we had the playoffs, and now we just have the championship left. And then, of course, the USDGC is around the corner, and we can dive into some of the things that were announced with regards to that today, too. So I guess there's no reason to wait any longer. It's late on the East Coast. So joining us now, Steve Dodge.
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Great. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful evening.
It is. And let's start off. One of the things that was just posted last evening was the addition to that wall. So you're a disc golfer. You've got discs on the wall. Tell us what's made the wall, because you're not always that much of a collector / hoarder / like super sentimental guy when it comes to Frisbees. So tell us about the wall behind you. Let's start there.
So it's fun you say that. This wall has been up for almost a week now. Mm-hmm. And actually maybe more than a week, because the tournament, I guess. But this Christmas, my brother got me all of the Maple Hill events signed by the champions. So in the top left back here is the 2004 MSDGC. I think my big head's in the way. And then it goes all the way over to, yeah, the first 19 discs now are signed by the champions, and the one white one in the middle. I'll go ahead and move this up. Is this a podcast or is this a video thing?
It's a little bit of both. So for our audio viewers, Steve is currently showing us the wall. So explain what we're looking at here, Steve.
All right. So up here on the top left is the 2004 MSDGC signed by Ron Russell and Des Redding. You got 05, 06, 07 all the way down. And then two nights ago, Simon Lizotte put this little bad boy up on the wall. The 2022 MVP Open signed by Natalie and Simon. So, and then all the other ones are just special discs to me. Like this is one that my daughters drew on and made a Vibram lace into a, looks like some sort of snow skier. So anyway, there's all sorts of good stuff up there.
Yeah, and some collectors and very much your time with Vibram certainly represented on there. I finally, as a host of the show, have nailed down the MVP Open at Maple Hill. And with that, I assume you're just going to change the name next year. Because every single time I finally...
It's about every 3-year cycle.
Yeah, every time I break a habit, you go ahead or get it and you fix the habit or whatever. You seem to change it. Now, I know you have this incredible relationship with MVP, but are you going to change the name on us?
I don't see why we wouldn't. I got a 10-year, $2 million deal, and I don't see why we wouldn't just throw that away.
Yeah, I mean, keep it spicy one way or another. I'm sure you'll come up with something.
One really exciting thing that happened this year, MVP came on board big time for us, which was really, really exciting. And it allowed us, we invested close to $100,000 in infrastructure on the course this year. And I just put out the spectator, how do we do survey? And so many people said, love the new bleachers, love the new spectator pads, nobody said they loved the new parking because we still don't have enough of it. Mm-hmm. But people were appreciative that there was more parking. We parked about 500 cars on site. And a few years ago, we were parking almost 300. So we're getting better and better on that end. And the one thing, as soon as you show somebody, hey, we got some bleachers up here, they're just like, hey, we need those bleachers on 11 and 2. And it's just like, okay, so we're not done yet. But with the great partnership with MVP, we're able to invest a lot of resources into making the course much more spectator friendly.
So let's start there, because fair or not, immediately some people saw the bleachers and then they were super concerned. It's amazing how once you get to the internet, everybody knows everything. I guess we've learned that. I'm not new here. But there was a lot of questioning and people worked up about the bleachers and how they were mounted. Did you see any of this blowback and or concern?
Of course. Maybe? I appreciate all the concern and the armchair contracting.
Yes.
And it worked out really well. We were able to look at it and shore a couple of things up that maybe should have been shorn up a little better. I don't have any idea about how you make something structurally solid.
Couple nails.
Just throw 200 people on it and see what happens.
Well,
that's
not going
anywhere. That's one way.
Right? I mean.
Well, but the guy that the guy here that built the bleachers and put the supports on it does know what he's doing. I'm confident that it would have worked fine. He put some window dressing on it, put a little extra, some extra ends to make it maybe more solid, but the guy on site who was expressing concern worked with him and they made it clearly safe enough.
Okay.
That's how we all want to be. Just safe enough. Good. And I'm glad. It's obviously it's just a testament. Some people are being genuinely helpful and some people are just being jerks to be jerks. So hopefully you can somewhere in the middle, you find that, hey, there was some concern and I knew it was all taken care of. But again, we're on the internet. So good to hear that was.
Just to say, I genuinely appreciate people questioning what I do because I make as you know, as Miles knows, as anybody who's worked with me more than once knows, I make plenty of mistakes. So question everything I do. And if I seem to be doing something right, give me an idea and I'll run with that one and someone else should question it.
So let's back up because I think when you were here last, we were actually largely talking about the $1 million shot and the opportunity. And then even after that conversation, I believe you had some additional concerns or clarifications that had to be made so that this could come to fruition, especially if somebody hit it and then it would get paid off and everything else. So the world, you know, fair or not, called the headline or not, the world definitely was excited about this shot or the opportunities this weekend. Kind of quickly recap, what went into even making that happen, just so the world knows? Like, how does that come about?
Somewhere in mid-January, I called my friend Mike Calzone over at Foy Insurance. And he's the same guy that insured the Pro Tour trailers and trucks and made sure that back in the day when the Pro Tour started, if things went more sideways than they did, then everything would have been fine. As far as like if the truck broke or something. But, and so I called him up. He's, and actually he does my car insurance and my house insurance now. Saved me a bundle. So, Foy Insurance, give him a call. But I called Mike and I said, Mike, I want to try a $1 million shot ace contest and see what this looks like. And he did some investigation and it finally all got resolved, I think probably about a month prior to the actual shot. There was a lot of back and forth. We used UDisc a lot to find, quote, similar holes to see how often people would get in circle one or circle two or parked. None of those holes were obviously birdied. They're, you know, a 600-foot par four is not going to be not going to be aced very often, and it wasn't. So used a lot of stats, used the video from last year's long drive contest, fed them and their actuaries a lot of data, and then they came back with some numbers, and it was really nice thinking 4 or 5 years ago this wouldn't even have been possible because there was no significant amount of data. They would have said it's a $1 million policy and, you know, good luck. And we actually ended up going through Lloyd's of London and we got pretty lucky on Thursday. The men's round was canceled. I don't know if anybody remembers that. It seems like a decade ago, yeah, but the men's round was the men's round was canceled on Thursday. And I called Mike while that decision was being made, I said, can we confirm that it's okay to push this to Saturday? And it was, we had to call England and get a reply fairly quickly.
Wow.
And then, it's a shame because we couldn't do the same thing with the women because it was a weekend and it just wasn't going to happen that quickly. Although Paige Pierce was a little miffed at that. She was like, we had to throw into a headwind and the guys are going to get a better day. And rightly so, because the women had a much harder chance with that. They had like a 15-mile-an-hour headwind. And so one thing we learned from this is going into the policy next year, we're going to ask them, we want to pick the best two nights for the weather. We're not going to define what night it is until the week of, and then we'll figure out what nights it'll actually happen. So anyway, a lot of stats went into it, a lot of money went into it, and I guess I could close by saying that on our end, Sarah Dodge, my niece, who does a bunch of video production, worked with DGN, and they coordinated the creating of a little show that went on the broadcast right after the live feed.
Well, first of all, I think it's awesome. And thank you for always continuing to push the envelope and come up with something new. Of course, there was, you know, I feel like there was criticisms. I don't even think is the right word. It probably is. But also just a lot of questions. I think people just questioning how stuff comes about, and they don't realize the massive amount of work and diligence that has to go into this. Clearly, it's for $1 million. Clearly, the insurance companies are going to want to make sure everything is as legitimate as possible. And honestly, that thought did cross my mind as to just the idea of like how difficult was it to change and how set were they on a particular day? Because right off the bat, I think of an insurance company who doesn't know anything about disc golf is like, well, you were going to do it on this day, but then somebody got a hole in one on a different day that we didn't even talk about. Like, I could understand how there could be, you know, how that all went down. Go ahead.
I was just to say, I'll just piggyback on that. We actually had to pay. This was an unexpected thing, but we actually ended up having to pay another $2,500 for an adjuster to come out from Boston, and it was his job to come out. We had to save him a spot in the VIP parking lot, make sure he got there. Wow. And he had to be on site. He got on the tee, he measured the basket, made sure it was far enough. The women's basket ended up being 455 feet, and the men's basket was 602 feet. So he came out and had to measure the whole thing, and then he had to go stand at the bottom and watch everybody throw and bear, you know, he was just there. So in addition to the minimum of four cameras, he was there to verify the whole thing. The amount of the number of T's that were crossed and I's that were dotted was astounding. And I'll just say thank goodness for Mike Calzone of Foy, because he handled all of that. He just said, hey, Steve, we need another check for this. Hey, Steve, we got a guy to do this, and this is going to happen. And he actually said that for the first time in his life, he hopes somebody has a claim.
Mm.
Would make sense.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, they have to do all of those things. And I think those things, yeah. And that's why I'm glad I asked, because so many of those things people never even remotely think about. Was there ever any pre-talked about contingency plan for inclement weather at all? Like whether it was wind or rain, or if the winds were 40 miles per hour, was that like, well, it is what it is. You just get whatever weather happens on that. Did you guys talk about weather at all?
We never talked about weather. It was always just, it only made sense to do this on, well, for me, it made sense to do this on Thursday, Friday. My goal was to utilize the $1 million shot to expand the number of people that wanted to come to the first 2 days.
Sure.
I knew Saturday and Sunday were going to sell out. I wanted to create some buzz and get some excitement for those first couple of days. And never really considered weather. And I wouldn't have even really considered weather except for the fact that the men's round was completely canceled. And I was like, so getting these guys to come out to the course, like, and they haven't warmed up. They haven't done anything all day. And then all of a sudden you're going to come and throw just three throws because you weren't allowed to practice the throw. So it would have been a mess. And it was obvious if we could move it, we needed to.
Okay. So you obviously you guys pushed that back to Saturday with some adjusting and some extra details, even thinking about the adjuster himself who had to come out then on Saturday when he was planning on Thursday and everything else, as you were saying. I got frustrated, and I know I read internet comments too much, but
the third time you
I get frustrated when there's uncontrollables. Like there's a lot of people that feel as if, well, why wasn't it shorter? Essentially, why wasn't it easier? and it's like you don't grasp the concept that this isn't supposed to be easy.
The
like,
easier it gets, the more expensive that insurance policy gets.
Yeah, and so I guess with that, though, is this insurance policy overall, does this go hand in hand with the East Coast Metal Roofing as the title sponsor. They're largely responsible, probably, for the insurance policy.
Who was it?
East Coast Metal Roofing.
You said it every time someone got up to throw, and I don't blame you. It just
tell me I didn't do it right.
You did it 100% right, Terry. It was beautiful.
I loved it, Terry.
I did too.
You someone, did, like, and I even commented while we were watching the live that night. I commented to whoever was sitting next to me. I love Terry Miller saying East Coast Metal Roofing $1 million shot every single time. It wasn't quite every single time, but it was plenty, and it was wonderful.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Huge shout out to Paul, the owner over there at East Coast Metal Roofing. He has probably 10 or 12 guys that play disc golf, most of them with Maple Hill as their original home course back in the early 2000s. And they are quite the crew over there, very disc golf centric. And I guess they're disc golf and metal roofing centric. That's their two. Those are their two things. I'm excited to for the shingles up above me to give out so that I can get a metal roof put on, because it's a one and done. It's exactly how I like to do things. But I don't know.
I would like a metal roof on my house as well.
Exactly. Anyway.
As asked on the board, someone said, you know, not only should it be easier, but another general philosophy is, could it be maybe shorter and easier, but at a smaller amount, like, and a more likely to hit, we'll say at $100,000. Were you
for
just
like a 450 foot shot or something
or whatever? Yeah. Were you just stuck on the idea that 1 million is such an impactful number, and therefore, you know, if it's that much harder than somebody hitting a shot for 100,000, do you feel like just the splash is that much bigger, and that's why 1 million was a number you were going after?
Yeah, absolutely. $100,000 shot today. I mean, you're buying a third of a house. That's not a big deal. I mean, it's a big deal. I don't want to disparage that. But $1 million shot, you're on every type of media in the world. And you have just like the Holy Shot, just like the Philotros, you have a significant impact in one go. And that was the reason. In my opinion, the $1 million shot sounds a lot better than the $100,000 shot. And that's the difference. So sure, you could move that basket up to 500 feet, pay about the same amount of money and have a $100,000 shot. But I go big or go home. That's how we do it.
Yeah, I just feel as if so many people expected it to be hit, and we all would have loved it, but there was this weird expectation of it. It's just not.
I gave like a 1 in 1,000 chance. Like,
yeah, what do they give you odds? You're the most numbers guy I know. Was there like an official odd?
They
on
ended
that?
Up. Because everybody got three shots, and we did not factor in the significant wind the women had, they gave it about a 1 in 100.
Really?
So each, and then they tacked on some for themselves. So with 24 shots, so it's actually a 1 in 2,400 shot to have the top players in the world aim at this thing, and then we gave them 24 shots, so the math works out. So it's about a 1 in 100 that would get hit. And the policy we paid was, I'll just go ahead and say it was close to $30,000, and with the adjuster was over $30,000.
I was pleasantly surprised at the entire setup, at the production, at the crowd. I kind of, in general, and granted I'm old and jaded at this point, all I kept thinking is like, ugh, I have to sit here and watch these guys just throw discs for whatever. I was legitimately excited.
You're welcome.
Not because of you, Terry. I don't believe you threw a disc.
That wouldn't have been exciting if I was.
For both the men and the women, obviously the women, we all kind of sat, we don't think they're going to get it because of the wind. But when the men the next day, it was the best distance competition I've ever seen. And we've seen quite a few of them in the last 20 years. So I was really happy, and it flew by. Let me say, it was pretty good.
When I checked my watch, our goal was to make a half hour production out of it. The women went very fast. It was cold. It was windy. And they just got up there and went. And God bless them for trying. And there were some legitimate, really good shots. But mm-hmm. sometimes you throw a perfect shot and then the wind just smacks you. So I feel really bad for the women. And I'll go ahead and plant this seed here. And maybe in 11 months, someone can remind me. In my opinion, the women had a much worse chance due to the weather. So maybe a week out from the tournament, we check the weather and we let the women choose first which night they want to go. And then the men get to choose second. And then we can alternate and go back and forth. Because as it turns out, the men had first choice this year, although nobody actually made a choice.
Sure.
But I think it would only be fair to give the women a significantly better chance next year and let them choose the weather first. Yeah, go ahead.
I'll just follow that up. I know I asked you privately, but clarify for the world as to the opportunities, because you said men versus women, then it also was very explicit in saying that the first person to hit the ace, and I love all yeah. of the closest to the pins to determine that, but clarify about one day versus another in terms of the women going one day and the men going the other, because I asked you a question midweek, and what did you say to me?
I think I said I love you too.
You said that, but I said if some woman hits it tonight, being Friday, all of the men still get to go and have their opportunity on Saturday? And
yeah, they were two separate policies valued at the same amount.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think is very important. I think that's worth mentioning because I'm sure somebody else was wondering if my big dummy head was wondering, and I'm sure somebody else's was.
I never even thought of that. And, honestly.
Well, that's because you're not a wait. You are. I don't know. Yeah, because there was such an
I just assumed
an emphasis that
it was two separate policies. I never once put it into my head that it would be the same thing when first person to hit it. The way you phrased it like that, I was like, oh yeah, I guess that does make sense, possibly. So
yeah, and if you know, if Natalie Ryan, who got the very first shot because she was number one in PPI, if she had hit it right out of the gate, the other competitors wouldn't even get a shot. Well, they could mm-hmm. still take a shot, but they wouldn't have a shot at the million. It would be done. And so what I meant by the women get the first choice, we'll have Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights next year that we have an opportunity to do it on. And we'll look at the weather and say, hey, you top six women, pick a night. And maybe we'll just do a vote by them. And then the men can do the same thing. I want to say I honestly, it's funny. I guess I don't look at the internet very much anymore.
Thank God.
Because I didn't see anything about the bleachers. I didn't see anybody complaining about the $1 million shot, saying it's too far, it's impossible, it's too easy. I didn't see any of that. Which is great. But
Terry hangs out on some seedy internet sites, let me tell you.
That's true. As soon as Albert Thom through that first shot, I had goosebumps for the next half hour because,
mm-hmm.
oh my God, I'm getting them again. Like anybody could have hit. They were right there. I mean, they were buzzing the tower.
Who was if you had to pick one of the MPO players who had the better weather to hit it, like if you had to give odds, who gets the best odds of hitting that amongst the men who threw?
Well, Albert and Paul were the closest, mm-hmm. so I would give them the best odds.
That's funny because I would have picked Albert or AB, just the way AB throws the power hyzer, the flat to hyzer.
Yeah,
I think he could have fought him and Albert both overpowered it.
Yeah,
as opposed to Paul, who didn't. He got closest, but I don't think he ever went past the basket. Not that he.
So it's interesting. I kept saying whenever they were pin high, I would let them know that. And I was trying to say, hey, guys, that's the right distance. Do that again. Just aim a little more left or right hope the wind's a little different. But you had the power right on. And I was talking to Paul after the event and he said, Steve, I just assumed you were being a carnival barker and trying to get everybody excited. I was like, no, I was really trying to help. So it was that was a pretty funny comment because Paul went to look at the basket. They were not allowed to take practice shots. That was that's part of the deal. So he went and looked at the basket afterwards and realized we had it elevated 5 or 6 feet on that big platform. And so he said it looked much closer to the wall to him. So he thought he was still 50 to 80 feet short. And he didn't realize how close he really was. Next, I don't really know what to do. Oh, you know what? I do know what to do. We have a video screen near the tee that shows how close the discs are, just like they did at the Beast.
Yeah. That's difficult. I would say that's difficult just from a production standpoint because those discs were everywhere. Like you've got one camera who's focused on the basket in the chance that it's going to come in.
That's true.
There was probably 80% of them where we just watched it go off into the nothing. It's like, all right, there goes that one behind a pine. There is that one behind a fir.
From FPO or MPO, and of course, we saw the wins, but was there anything that ultimately surprised you with it? Like anything with the competition? With either, I know the FPO had the wins, but I'm saying just in general with the competition over the 2 days, was there anything that surprised you with regard to the actual contest?
I just tore my I tore my earbuds out.
He was so offended at your question. Now is when we can talk bad about him.
That's true.
All right.
He's doing
technical difficulties. I don't know if you guys could hear me yelling.
Yep, we hear you.
Yeah, there you go. We can edit that out in post. Whoops.
Yeah, yes. That's what we'll do.
Yeah, certainly. Definitely. We're known for our editing skills.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because we usually shorten up our podcast. No, my question was...
Were you surprised at anything during the competition?
I heard the question. The thing I was most surprised about was how good-natured and happy everybody was. Obviously, there's no downside. Nobody spent any money to take those shots. It was just totally skill-based and fan vote-based. But looking at Paul and Ricky and Simon, of course, all just standing there excited. They look like little kids.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't in the second and third rounds, they didn't necessarily know the order because it was based on CTP. And it was fun because we'd say, okay, up next. And you could see Paul like move his foot onto the tee and then be like, oh, I have to wait. And it brought me such joy. It brought me such joy to see how happy those guys were. That would be my biggest takeaway. And the fact that they can throw 600 feet pretty accurately.
Yeah.
But seeing how happy those guys were, was probably one of the highlights for me.
Was there anyone in the field that you looked at the field and thought, I'd like to see them take a shot at it that didn't get a chance to throw?
Gannon Burr.
Mm. Oh yeah.
After the fact, it was kind of fun. So the whole thing finished, and then like 20 top pros jumped on the tee and just started throwing. Mm-hmm. And I remember the staff were down there and they collected a lot of the discs, maybe all of the discs, and brought them to the base of the structure. And then they were just like, wait a minute, what's going on? Like, there's just hundreds more discs now. And I think that, I don't know for sure, but I think that Gannon Burr actually hit the platform.
Okay.
And I saw him take 3 shots and they were right there. He is an impressive person.
Yeah, it's too bad he's not probably old enough to claim it or something, being only 17. They would have to fly his mom in to sign for the check or something.
Goes into a trust fund.
All right. Well, speaking of checks and the overall event, let's get right into it. We saw, of course, the incredible playoff in the morning. Well, first of all, we'll start the 4 rounds that took place. So maybe before we even talk about the FPO division, the idea, I mean, how kind of bizarre, right? 4 rounds for FPO, only the 3 for the men. Any clarification or thing you want to say about how that decision came about, that it ultimately was 4 for women and 3 for men? And then why didn't we still have a cut for FBO for the 4th round as planned?
Why didn't we have a cut for the FBO? I believe that that decision was made to be consistent between the divisions as much as possible. Mm. I did hear from some of the women that they were glad that there wasn't a cut. It was different than what was anticipated, but I think that was done just to be consistent with the MPO. In my opinion, the Pro Tour did a really good job of handling the weather delay and balancing the concerns of the players with the needs of a tournament. You've got a tournament. Your goal is to get as much disc golf in as possible. You've got lightning delays. If the MPO had started and only a few of the cards had gotten on, which is what would have happened, mm-hmm. It would have been a very big mess the next day, because the mm-hmm. women wouldn't have been able to play, and we would have in fact shortened both divisions to 3 to 3 rounds if that had happened, in all likelihood. It would have been a big mess, and I'm really glad the way the Pro Tour handled that entire situation.
What's the communication like between you, your staff, and then the Disc Golf Pro Tour staff? What is that what's that conversation like? Who's kind of driving the bus, and do you just provide feedback? Do you rubber stamp stuff? Like what is that communication like in that conversation?
So for the weather delays, I even commented how happy I am with the way the situation is. I don't call anything. I remember three, four, 5 years ago, it was on the event to say, okay, the lightning is too close and we've got to call it, or there's too much rain and there's tee pads are flooding or whatever it is, and we've got to call it. And now it is 100% on the Pro Tour. I obviously have input, and if I said, hey, I think there's an issue because of such and such, would be listened to, no problem. No concerns on that. But Seth Muncy of the Pro Tour makes the call and says, okay, we need to stop now. There was lightning. It's fast moving. It was within this distance, or it was even closer and it's slow moving, or whatever it is. Their software was much better than the software that I had. And I actually loved looking at it and seeing all the different strikes. And player safety is paramount to the Pro Tour, and hearing all the conversations and then also the input from the players was critical as well. Whether or not they feel safe and whether or not they feel listened to is important. So I was very impressed with the level of communication between, I guess, and the PDGA was there as well. So between all of the disparate groups. And then as soon as we got word, we were able to pass it on to the spectators and then pass it on to our staff. And then the Pro Tour disseminated it to their end, and the PDGA, I assume, disseminated through PDGA.com and other channels.
Yeah, because of all the things at Maple Hill, it feels like the one big complaint is the tee pads. When they get wet, they get slick. In dry weather, it feels like nobody really has too much of a problem with them. But during inclement conditions, those tee pads do not have the best reputation. Have you taken any of that? Clearly you've probably heard that from a year. I mean, this isn't new. This is something that we've known for years.
Correct. And one of the big things, to your point, is if a tee pad has these pavers and is in the shade, it tends to get more algae growing on it than if it's in the sun. And so I guess Tuesday or Wednesday before the tournament, we bleach clean all of the tee pads that are concerns. And I did hear one of the top female players who had complained about the tees and was concerned after the round said actually the tees were pretty good. And it was said in a surprised way. Like, so we do hear those concerns and we do address those concerns. Having said that, I do remember seeing in the final round, I think I saw Ricky slip on 17. Yeah. And there, that front left corner of the 17 tee pad, I feel like there was noticeable mud on the tee, as a remnant. Mm-hmm. And that, other players would kind of avoid that area. And Ricky just happened to step in an area that was in fact quite slippery. It's something we work to address. We do clean the tee pads every year before the tournament, and we're doing our best to mitigate it.
I'm going to take a quick tangent to that, and since I know you're a man who will take feedback and or put this maybe even on a dream or bucket list, and maybe some of the media guys already said this, as a commentator and as a guy who's been there, if I had a couple of dream items to add, it would be an extension off the back of nine. And I know these are all structural, costly things to do. I'm not, you know, ignorant to that, but an extension off the back of nine's tee, just so there's plenty of room for both cameramen and players. Cause there's always that awkwardness. Even me, who's filmed there dozens of times, there's that awkwardness of like, well, does the player mind me on the tee with them? And if I'm in a corner and then we're not getting a great shot anyway,
I like looking up James Conrad's shorts
or you're standing down looking up, which kind of looks cool for a moment. It's such a great hole, but it's so difficult to cover. And I know we've had, you know, Todd up in a tree on the catch, but I'm just thinking if again,
yeah, where were you, Todd?
In our dream world, if somehow and I don't know how old or not that teapad is in the first place, that whole structure on nine, but in a dream world, that's extended by 8 or 10 feet back. We'll have to get some engineers out there to make that happen. And then in a similar sense, the challenge with four, and everybody throws on four, and then the second they throw, they step into the like 2 inches we have to view.
Right.
And it, right. Again, I understand all of these things, but if we're creating a bucket list of minor things that could be helpful from a media, selfishly, of course, from a media perspective, some kind of little tower up behind four, and I know that could come in to play with threes basket.
There's been a bench back there before that our guys have stood on, and I've usually, as a director, try to take the shot from the catch, but that doesn't always work because if they catch a tree early, it wrecks my shot. I always just trust that all our players are perfect, and they're gonna pipe it.
It's their fault.
So I'll say two things to that, Terry. First of all, because of that question, so we have a spectator survey that we sent out. We'll send a staff survey out as well. I'm going to go ahead and this year add in a media survey because that's those two things that you pointed out are. One of them is an easy, relatively easy fix. The giving you a platform on hole four to stand on won't be that hard. And if there's something that we can do that would improve the media experience, it's definitely worth doing. If it, mm-hmm. presuming it's not too costly, I guess if it's worth doing, it's worth doing. That's how we do it. And on hole nine, so I'm going to do a media survey. So look for that in the next day or two. One more thing for you to do, Terry.
Good.
And
good.
Then
that's what I'm hoping. That's what I needed.
On hole nine, I got to experience the eight holes again this year. I think they knocked it out of the park. I love the way the energy they bring to the entire course. And I love that the 14ers are stepping up their game. Mm-hmm. And who knows exactly what's going to happen long term. I hope the people at 11 and 13 understand that place is called the Cutler Place. That hill is called the Cutler Place so that they don't misname themselves like the 11 13ers or something. But mm-hmm. They're actually going to be like Cutlers or something. But on hole nine, one of the things that I'm going to ask Gage to do, and I haven't talked to him yet, so he'll probably hear about it in about 5 minutes when someone calls him. I want to look for another tee pad 50 feet to the left of where hole nine's current tee pad is. And get it farther away from the eight holes.
Yeah.
Because that...
Let's get away from those eight holes.
I understand people out on 14 and all over the course, you know, they hear the noise from hole eight, but the people on the tee of nine, like they're right there. And the cheers on hole eight are not in cadence with what's going on the tee of hole nine. Mm-hmm. So that's one that I actually think should be addressed. The extension on the tee is fine, but I think a whole different tee would actually be warranted there.
Yeah, it's too bad because I really love the, and maybe there's a space over there. I was going to say, I love how just almost dead straight the hole plays. And but, you know, coming maybe from an angle, it could still be relatively straight. It's going to have a little bend in it at some point. But yeah, I mean, again, that's totally selfish. And I've been there and we saw some of that this weekend. A couple times players said, hey, can you back up? Or they're good with it and you're just kind of awkwardly standing there and or you're getting a shot up James Conrad shorts, which
I mean, it's for somebody. The eight holes, they bring a lot of energy. They're a lot of fun. Do you feel like there's a point where it could be overboard? I mean, we heard Nate Sexton and Nate Doss on the commentary. We were going to go to commercial off of the eight holes, kind of doing their big clap as they do. And suddenly somebody gets on the green and they start announcing players' names and then they start clapping. And then there's the flags and at what point does it become a distraction? Because as Nate had said, they wouldn't necessarily love it in the heat of battle, having to wait on eight while these guys do their full routine, so to speak. Is there a point where we need to kind of tone them down? Sadly, I mean, they're such a great addition for a lot of things.
So one really nice thing is that Zach Benson, who is where's the crown?
Mm-hmm. He's the king.
I don't want to announce. I can't decide who's king out there. I can only say he's wearing the
it's
crown.
Like Lord of the Flies, we know.
But he is I would say he's sort of quasi staff at this point. If there's something that needs to be done on hole eight. We can just task him to do it and we know it's going to be done. So anyway, he works very closely with us and if there's a genuine concern, we bring it up to him and he brings it to the primary eight holes and then it disseminates from there. I have not looked into, exactly what happened on the, I think it was just the final card, but I'm not sure where it I've heard different varying stories and I need to try to pin this down at some point, but I've heard that there was a delay there. I've also heard there was reasons for the delay, but I haven't sussed out what those were. In my opinion, I wouldn't want the eight holes to impede the pace of play. They should be calling out the names before the people get to the tee. I don't have a problem with Zach getting on the green and leading the crowd the way that he does with his slow claps. But if they're not done with their production before the people reach the tee, then something should be modified.
Yeah, it was funny just because we were going to go to commercial off of, like, again, the clapping when they started the production. And then at one point we're like, all right, I guess we're just staying here then. Because by the time they were done with the full thing, it was time for everyone to tee off. And so rather than go to a commercial and then put everything in replay, we just went live. And I didn't have a problem with it, but that's when Nate had brought up whether or not the players were waiting, whether it was something else. Because I know there's some talk about them and the 14ers. We got to get a better name for them, but we'll stick with 14ers for now. Distracting other cards. And I don't really have a problem with that personally. I think that's now become part of the play, part of the atmosphere, part of what you need to focus and concentrate on while you're at Maple Hill, because those the 8 holes can be heard literally from hole one through probably 15?
No, every hole.
Every hole.
Every hole.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, it's... and we saw a couple times players have to stop, regroup, and start their process again because of a mistimed cheer to them. Maybe they're on hole 11 and
or 5
or 5 or something like that. But I personally don't have a problem with that aspect of it. I like the excitement. I love the cheering. it makes it difficult as a, from the production, because we're used to hearing cheers like that and assume something big happened, like, yeah, oh, there's an ace right. somewhere on the course, or somebody's hit a huge putt, let's look on UDisc.
Not someone tickled a tree and then skirted it's, near OB and then like, stopped, and stopped 28 feet away.
And then you hear the crowd eruption. So it
or someone walked to a tee.
That too, yeah.
There's a huge eruption.
But the good thing is we can tell on 14 when who hit the ace? That was Alex Benson.
Alex Benson.
When Alex Benson hit the ace, because that was more of an eruption and a lasted thing. And so we kind of knew at that point something big had happened.
So I'm glad you bring up that shot, because I think I was watching Nick and Matt the other night. And either Nick or Matt Graham told a story. But the 8 holes, it's interesting because is it more disruptive to have constant clapping occur, every minute or two, or is it more disruptive to have the group in front of you have a big shot and just have loud clapping all of a sudden? Because both are going to happen in a disc golf tournament. And the story that I heard was Missy Gannon was putting on hole 9, which is on the opposite side of hole 14 when Alex hit that ace. And so she was all lined up, and then that the big eruption happened, and to her credit, she paused and said, okay, I'm not going to.
She actually gave a little applause too. Like, she turned around, looked, and I think realized what happened and gave a little golf clap.
And then when she was resetting, maybe Alex was running down the dam, or a bunch of people were running down. I don't exactly know. And then the crowd erupted again as she's approaching the basket. And she was just like, okay, what's going on now? And then I think that she putt and missed and maybe rolled out of bounds. And these are the things that are going to happen. We're all on the same property. And having said that, Maple Hill, I think, is actually more spread out than most courses. If you're playing Maple Hill and there's 18 groups out there that are well spaced, you might not even know there's other groups out there during an ordinary day, because the holes are all pretty well spaced out and they're all self-contained for the most part. So,
yeah,
that's just going to happen.
No, and that's a good point, is that there's constant excitement and applause and eruptions really from sun up to sundown out there, and that probably overall is easier to get used to than just the one or two bursts you might hear in a day, coming from, like you said, an ace or something of that nature. And it's obviously an electrifying crowd and a lot of excitement out there, and it's crazy to see so many people get into it for so long, and then what it's evolved from too. I think it goes along with so much of the rest of the tournament, to where it's come from. So we all derailed ourselves. FPO.
Oh yeah.
Back to the actual golf, but FPO.
Wait. Let me say real quick. I know that we have the best staff in the world, and I say it every time, and the staff gets better and better. And like, now they're marking discs in the middle of the fairway, like they're putting a little flag. And these guys are fantastic. But I think for the first time, I genuinely believe we have the best spectators as well. They come out, they are respectful, they have so much fun. They listen to the staff that says, hey, go around over here. What? Wait, what?
Well, there was one.
All but one guy.
There's one guy.
How'd that guy get in?
I just think the best question of the whole weekend is, well, why'd you move it? I don't know. Like, why'd you pick it up?
What are you talking about?
On hole 14, during during the round.
It was this, I believe, the second.
I think it was the chase card.
Ben
with
Callaway.
Ben Callaway threw a shot. He was way off to the left side,
into the woods,
on the left side of 14.
Oh,
and at some point, it was brought to our attention that some guy picked it up.
He just walked over, picked up the disc,
and so they had to determine where it was. And so they put it back, and Robert Leonard's on camera with us at this point, and he says, well, why'd you pick it up? Why did you touch it, or why'd you pick it up? Whatever he said. The guy just goes, I don't know.
It was a little bit more slurry. I don't know.
Like, it was just like,
I think it was someone who had a little too much fun, maybe just saw a disc there, didn't realize there was a group on the tee, and just was like, oh, there's a disc here. Not realizing, oh yeah, there's a tournament. I mean, realizing there's a tournament going on, but maybe not realizing there's a card coming, and just literally with a little bit of help in this bloodstream, just walked over and, hey, I got it. There's a disc here.
It was.
So, I'll take this up to Lost and Found.
Yeah.
Never mind the guy that's walking to it, trying to play from it on the chase card.
But you're I do agree, though. You guys, I think, do have the best spectators, pretty much most respectful, and probably some of the most knowledgeable in on the tour.
And they have so much fun. It's really, really fun how much fun they are having. I get joy from it. And if we want to talk about drunk spectators, I actually do have one fun story.
Okay.
Please.
Because we know how much you like to drink. So this is clearly, you under a different name.
I have a friend.
Yes.
You guys know, I don't know if it's Phil Delaney.
Phil Delaney, yeah. On the Disc Golf Pro Tour staff. Yep. Yeah.
I'm gonna share a story that he shared with me. He saw a spectator who clearly was having he was drunk, okay. And Phil said, "Sir, you need to leave the course. You're gone." And the guy was super respectful. He said, "I'm so sorry. I don't normally drink this much." And then he looked up at Phil and he goes, "Are you Drew Gibson?"
Phil's like a foot and a half taller than Drew, but yeah.
Well,
wow.
Yeah. Are you? And Phil says, "No, I'm not Drew Gibson." And he says, the guy says, "If you're Drew Gibson, I'll walk off the course with you."
Wow. Like, Drew would be doing crowd control in the first place.
You don't
place.
Know. Drew could.
Maybe. Maybe. I mean, wow. Okay.
I thought that was a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. Huh. Well, with that, though, comes, you know, these viewers show up, you have VIP parking, you know, you fit more in this year than ever before. I know there has to be tournament parking for the players and all this other stuff. That maybe is one of the good challenges or drawbacks to this. You have so many people. Did I see in an email, people are parking at an airport, the local regional airport down the road, and are trying to Uber in or walk to the course? Like, clearly parking, there's only so much you can do about that, right? I mean, and is this such a good problem to have?
Well, you know, it's funny. Good problems are still good. That's one thing we have to remember.
Mm-hmm.
Good problems are still good. We actually have a very comprehensive plan for next year's parking already, and we will make it more robust as we go. We are planning on hiring two shuttle buses that will be shuttling people in from offsite parking, which we anticipate will be probably about half of all spectators will be parking offsite. Every year I take it as a personal challenge to try to get as many cars on site as I can. And next year, because the shuttle worked so well this year, and it wasn't a professional shuttle, it was just us. Next year we're going to have a professional shuttle, every 12 minutes going back and forth from wherever the parking lot is. There's four or five potential parking lots. We just have to work with the town to figure out what the best one is. And so that's going to bring about half the people in, and then all of the other lots, we're going to reduce the cars by about 10% and make parking on site basically stress free. So it'll be easier on the staff. It'll be easier on the people parking on site. We'll use the opportunity of the shuttle to inform people of the what's happening that day. You know, give them a little card that says, here's the schedule for today. Hit the person on the shuttle will be able to scan people in and give them all their passes. And so when they get off the bus, they're all scanned and they just go. There's a lot of advantages to being able to shuttle people in. It'll be it says it's a 6-minute trip from the farthest of the four lots. So that's a fine amount of time in a shuttle. And I think you'll be able to check in up to 10 people pretty easily in that time frame. So that's, we have a really good plan already to address the parking, because that is a big deal. The other big deal that I see, in this, it was fun looking over the spectator answers, because people wanted more diverse food. They wanted a coffee vendor. They wanted bleachers on hole 2. They wanted bleachers on hole 11. And it's really fun, because now that people see the bleachers, like, oh, wow, let's put them there and there and there. And they don't realize those bleachers are not free. So, but we're happy to invest, and we will grow and grow and grow. But the big thing that I see is making it so that we can get more people around hole 18. We can put people at hole 8, and we can put people at 14, and we can put people at the Cutler place on 11, 13. And at hole 1 and in the woods, if you have the gold pass and all, we can spread people out on the course, and people are getting used to the idea of sitting in a spot and watching the cards come through. And then when the lead women's card go through, you follow them. And then when they finish, you go back to your spot and you watch the lead men card. And so we can spread people out during the day, but at the end of the tournament, we need to be able to fit 1500 people around hole 18. So bleachers around hole 18 is, or a solution around hole 18is the next big hurdle. And I would say that's what we're going to address most, this next year. Okay. And I believe parking is not going to be an issue ever again going forward.
Awesome.
Fantastic.
Do you have any idea? You have some idea probably then of what were the numbers like for you this year in terms of spectators? And do you feel like weather significantly impacted that one way or another? Obviously there weren't as many on Thursday afternoon. I'm not an idiot, but, overall, how much, what were you looking at for some of your numbers?
Saturday and Sunday were sold out, 1,250 tickets each day. And Friday we sold close to 1,000, and then Thursday was not, it was probably around on the 500 to 600.
Do you feel like though, I mean, are those numbers just right? I mean, how, you know, at a certain point there's saturation and, or yeah, you're hurting the viewing experience of being there. I know you just talked about ways to address some of that, but is there a magic number in mind?
The goal next year will be to, so last year in 2021, we had 625 tickets sold on Saturday and Sunday. Mm. And I looked at hole 18 and I, in my scientific way, I said, I think we can have about twice as many people. And so I doubled it. With some increased infrastructure, I think we can have about 20% more people around hole 18. So we're going to go up to 1,500 tickets.
Okay. I like it.
I shouldn't say that definitively. I should say that's my current plan. But it's been all of 3 days since the event. So
yeah, and you're not one to change your mind on stuff. So so it came down to 18. Obviously in overtime for the FPO and what very close to overtime for MPO, but on the FPO side, the four rounds, it comes down to our world champ against Natalie Ryan, who's won earlier in the season, of course, at D-Glo, very different course. And she put a stop to Kristen, who's won the last four events she's entered, of course, being a Silver Series, a couple of Elite Series, and a major. Can you draw that up any better? I mean, is the only thing better than a two-person playoff is a three-person playoff? I mean, like, talk about the FPO side and maybe even the
the battle of Paige charging in the last day, and then Natalie versus versus Kristen. Is there anything you want to chime in on any of that? I mean, yeah,
I will go ahead and say one thing. I personally wanted to have a hole one and hole 18 aggregate playoff.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like one hole playoffs are not enough for, I'll just say Elite Series. For Elite Series and up. I think an Elite Series, a major, going to a one hole playoff is, and Robert Leonard actually pointed this out. He said the last two world championships were both decided with a one hole sudden death playoff on an island hole.
Mm-hmm. 16, both times. Hole 16.
Both times. Potentially could be viewed as a little fluky, where obviously if you throw it on, you throw it on, but things can happen. Like that, if we made our one hole eight, I think, you know, Gannon Burr hit the basket and almost rolled out of bounds. That would mm-hmm. be a bad way to lose. I like the idea of if you lose that first hole, or in this case, it would be hole one, then you have an opportunity to come back on hole 18 and play aggressive and try to get the birdie and force the other person to get a birdie as well. And maybe they end up bogeying and you end up winning. And like I think it increases the fairness to the players and the excitement for the spectators. And in this case, one and 18 are both iconic, and one is righty friendly and 18 is lefty friendly. So I think it, like the balance works out in a lot of ways. So, that's the one thing that I personally would have liked to have seen different. But overall, I mean, wow, what an amazing finish.
And you just didn't get an exemption for that. Is that what I heard? Because we had talked to, originally, it was discussed that was the playoff structure, and then something that was some miscommunication.
You could call it miscommunication. It's more of me never even considering that there could be a rule about that. Like, why would they make a rule about that? Mm. So I didn't ask for an exemption until Thursday. or it might have been Wednesday, but I think it was Thursday. And then the competition committee actually had a meeting that night and discussed it and said no.
Because it was just short notice. I mean, the concept's not completely unique or crazy. So...
They didn't say it was because of short. Well, actually, it's kind of funny. They did say they wanted to have time to discuss it. And my thought was I thought that's what you were doing at the meeting. But I threw something on the agenda very late. So maybe they didn't have time to discuss it at the meeting because they had other things. It felt like a slam dunk to me. I wish it had happened. It didn't. Hopefully next year the rules can be tweaked for Elite Series and up. And if we want to have aggregate hole playoffs, we can do it.
Yeah.
And, I love the idea. I've said it for years.
Yeah. And I'll throw a couple of quick clarifiers in there. One, the rule by default, if I think the rule currently stands as if there's a playoff, unless otherwise determined by a tournament director, it is sudden death starting on hole one. I believe that's how it's officially stated in the competition manual. And then secondly, at some point during the final round, I was sent a link to the idea that it was going to be 18 and then a hole one aggregate. I was sent that because it was listed that way on UDisc. And it's something I usually think about. And anytime we have a close battle, whether I'm in the field or in the booth, I start thinking ahead to that, if it's even a remote possibility. And so I was sent to the link from UDisc. That's where it had it listed. I said it. I surprisingly got it out relatively clearly. Then I said it again on my own accord a little later. And then before the third time I was about to ever say it or mention it again, it was put into my ear. Hey, just so you know, there wasn't a waiver granted. That's not the case. It's not happening. And I was like, awesome. I'm glad I was wrong twice. And I'm going to fall on the sword. So that's why I then had to come back and I made a clarification. And at that point, I didn't know what waiver by whom. I didn't know any of those details. It doesn't really matter. But I'm glad on my own accord I said it incorrectly twice. So That's how it went down, because then naturally the internet does its interneting and was like, well, wait, someone changed it. Who changed it? Why aren't they? Terry said it was going to be that way, and they didn't hear the explanation or whatever. So as if there was some kind of favoritism or something silly, I don't know. So, yeah.
You and I have worked together for well over a decade now.
Yeah.
And yeah. I didn't make a bet with Jesse, but I was like, I know at some point I'm going to do something that causes Terry to say a wrong information. And I'm so happy that we finally have that behind us.
Yes, yes. It was. And honestly, when I heard there was an exemption, I didn't know if that was a pro tour thing. I didn't know if that was just strictly a PDGA thing. I didn't even know it doesn't matter who to really point the finger of blame at, but
you were wrong.
Yeah, me. It was just me, because I was reading what was on UDisc. So clearly, I'm the idiot here.
This is the guy to point the finger at.
Okay,
right here.
Now I know. Good.
I didn't read the competition, whatever that other book is,
manual,
and that says you have to have a sudden death playoff. And it honestly, it's never occurred to me that you couldn't do a two-hole playoff. Like, why would that be a rule? But that is a rule, and so you need a waiver. And
I think it's so people can't just make shit up whenever they want.
We're going to do an 18-hole playoff.
Yeah. Oh, we're going to go play the odd numbered holes, you know, from the short pads, and the even numbered holes from the long pads. Like, I think it's for that exact reason. There's a default, and then that's to safeguard so random stuff doesn't just get made up, which, you know, lots of TDs would otherwise do. I do love the idea. I'll go on record and agree with you guys. I think that's a great idea. I think
so.
Yeah.
That error is mine, because I didn't ask for the waiver in enough time to give them time to discuss it. So that's on me.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, maybe I should write an email right now saying, hey, can we do it next year?
That would be a good idea. We've also seen implemented the rule that I really also like this year with when it gets to the playoff is that, you know, there's a coin that's flipped to determine who goes first. That used to always
be that rule.
By default, the person who had the hotter previous round. So that coin flip, and then having it alternate anytime after mm-hmm. that. I certainly like that application as well. So, and I know that's been a pro tour thing,
at least for this year,
it. Yes.
Yeah, I agree with you, Terry. I think that's a great change and another argument for a two-hole aggregate playoff.
Sure.
Give them an opportunity to obviously, if somebody wins the hole, the first hole, they're going to go first on the next hole. But maybe it's not obvious, actually. So, but give both people an opportunity to go first if it's a tie or the person going second wins.
The only minor downside, and I was thinking about just, again, the geography, the only super minor downside to 18, then one, and if you're for sure playing one, is then
spectators
picking
moving.
Everybody up and moving them out of where they were, because you're saying they have to stay put, or what?
No, the aggregate was going to be hole one and then 18. I wanted them to finish on 18. So
okay, well, that's
I don't
not
know
also
where
not eight- how because that's not how it was listed on UDisc. It was listed as them playing 18 again and then going to one. So that's how I shared it with the
right.
world. So that's where
so I don't
wrong,
know
Terry.
Why yeah. I don't know why it was listed 18-1. It was supposed to be 1 and 18.
Well, that's life, and it's we at least understand now why it happened and what's going on.
So did you guys want to talk about FPO now?
Yeah, no, I mean,
yeah,
I mean, I don't even know if there was a tournament. Yeah, I mean, give us. I mean, okay, Johnny, how about this? Johnny's going to read your top eight players.
Top
off,
eight players.
Just as a refresher,
Natalie Ryan winning in the playoff over Kristen Tatar. Third place, Paige Pierce making a stellar run after a lot of people have kind of talked about her being on the downslide of her career over the last month, which is insane to me. Holland Hanley tied with Deanne Diesel Carey for fourth place. In fifth place was Evelina Salonen. Sixth place, the ageless wonder, Owen Scoggins, who took fourth in the Pro Tour points this year, by the way, might mm-hmm. I add. Phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Eighth place, Ella Hansen. Ninth place, Macy Valadiez, tied with Henna Blumroos.
So there's your top 10. That's
how you say it, Terry? Blumroos?
That's another topic.
We can get into that later.
So there's your top 10. Quick take on that. Any thoughts?
I would say they all played great to get there.
Yeah.
Are you surprised? I'll follow that up.
I'm a little surprised at the top four are some of our furthest throwers. Power throwers. And people don't think of Maple Hill as a power course. Like Natalie Ryan, Kristen Tatar, Paige Pierce, and Holland Hanley. I mean, if you want a distance competition, you pick those four practically.
And especially, I'll go ahead and say the women's course, the diamond course at Maple Hill, about 3 years ago, we made it much more technical. Mm-hmm. And we started to dial it back to try to balance it out a little bit more with opening up a couple of holes. But I agree with you, Johnny. It's definitely not a distance heavy.
Yeah. So I was a little surprised at seeing particularly, I mean, Holland Hanley's a phenomenal player. She's a pretty good putter, but she's known for her distance. Natalie Ryan, known for her distance. Kristen Tatar, all-around player. And Paige Pierce is an all-around good player, but also known for her distance. I mean, you get that way when you're like a four-time world champ or five-time world champ, whatever she is these days. Yes. Six-time, eight. I'm not sure anymore. Yeah, five-time world champion.
I think when I see that list, and even in the top 10, as Johnny just read them off, the two names you don't see are the two of the more previous champions that we often see in literally everywhere, Katrina Allen and Sarah Hocum. You know, two women that know the course and know how to win there.
Yeah.
And they're both having, you know, their struggles or not. Or they just didn't play up to, you know, to the standards of the other women. But to not see a Katrina Allen or a Sarah Hocum, I think it's fair to say that's also pretty surprising, especially given the course and their longevity.
I would agree with that entirely.
So
you guys are very good at this analysis thing.
Yeah, thanks. You know, that's what we do. okay, maybe not.
And I will go ahead and say when you're running an event, when I'm running an event, I'm not able to pay attention to what's going on during the event. I knew that Deanne Carey had gotten fourth because she hadn't done that well at an elite series before, and that was one of the things that I heard about. I did not realize that she had tied Holland Handley, and it makes me a little bit embarrassed because Holland parked in my driveway and I asked her if she had a good tournament. I'm just not aware. I know that Kristen and Natalie were in the playoff, but there's a lot of moving parts to an event this big, and I'm not able to be aware of all of the stuff that's going on the course. I'm trying to make sure all the staff and all the spectators and all the players have what they need to be happy.
Yeah. And I, when I look at that final round, one of the other major things that just jumps off the page is what Henna was doing out there. The fact that, you know, she had a little bit of a slow start. She was even through five, but then went on to get five birdies in a row, parred 10, and then got two more birdies after that. So what is that? 7 out of 8 holes. And was, you know, seemingly just destroying the course, and then ran into a common problem, which is her short range putting. You know, that happened on 17. We saw that all on air. We didn't see what happened on 18. She have two OBs. Is that what I saw?
She had two OBs.
So that's easy to add up strokes there. But
especially with the way after 17 went. I mean, she was clearly distraught after her 5-putt on 17.
Yeah.
Just going back and forth on that elevated basket.
So she birdied 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and then 12, 13?
No, she, 5 through 9 she birdied.
Oh, 5 through 9. Okay.
Wait, am I looking? Yeah.
No. I apologize. Yeah, five through nine.
And then 11 and 12. She missed hole 10.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that's, I think, funny, she had a look at those, it.
Hole 10 would be, I mean, that's a power hyzer. I think she's got that in her bag.
She does.
She missed a circle 2-putt. She, okay. So she was in circle two and missed it and then hit the circle one putt from 15 feet.
Hitting 11 and 12 is pretty good too. And yeah, so that's a great stretch. And yeah, I'm sorry that she ended up with
yeah,
with
she went
that,
triple bogey, triple bogey to finish out. But certainly, you know, was proving, though, like, hey, this course can get shredded. And that's exactly what she was doing throughout that section of the course and was very much making a charge and being in the conversation, but ultimately came up short. And, so,
and I did see that the women played much better on Saturday, Sunday than they did Thursday, Friday, with the Thursday, obviously, with the rain and wind, and then Friday with the tremendous wind. I did see scores getting much better. And when we do our analysis, like we do have to bear in mind the weather is a significant factor. In my opinion, you can't look at Thursday and Friday and say, okay, this course is too hard. You have to look at the days when they had an opportunity to score.
Yeah. And what I think jumped off the page most for me, it was just how glaringly obvious it becomes that wind affects the play so much more than the actual rain, because the scores from round one, albeit weren't, you know, wildly amazing, they also weren't as bad as what I feel like they could have been. Like
your top 15, just looking at the scores, averaged, we'll say, two over par, one to two over par. For your top 15 players on round one, other than Natalie Ryan, who shot a plus seven. So it is kind of amazing that she came back. But then you go to round two and you see the scores significantly higher. They look like they're averaging more like, you know, three
roughly
or four.
Roughly 8.62 over par.
Oh, look.
As a division.
There you go. Wow, Terry.
Roughly.
I never, honestly, and this is a stats thing, I hate looking at that particularly, although that gives you a general good idea. I like to look at usually the top 15 to 20 players, because a lot of times we do see players that do not, I don't want to say should not be playing in the FPO field, but maybe are not at the caliber that we see. So when we see somebody have stroke gained over the field, you know, 10.7, I'm thinking like, yeah, but what are they versus like the top 20 women? But I get it. Like that is a relatively good descriptor of how much worse, because everybody's playing, you know, bad.
So
Steve Dodge. I actually froze
up. Or is anybody watching this live?
Yeah, we watch people. Yeah, people watch this live.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a few people there.
There's a few.
Hopefully all of them chime in, so we get a couple of different comments here. My question is, hole 18, I'm ready to switch over to MPO. Are you guys ready?
Yep. Yeah, let's move over to MPO. Okay.
On hole 18, that tee was moved back and is pretty darn far back there.
Which year?
And whenever we moved it back to its current location.
That was what? I think that was 3 years ago.
I think
this is
it was
a funny
3 years
story with
ago
Nate Doss,
well.
But go on. Go on.
You can tell that later.
So in 2020 and 2021, it averaged 10% birdies. In 2022, it averaged 15% birdies. And on the final day, overall 2022, on the final day, it averaged 21% birdies, which is kind of amazing. My question is that hole was designed for two players, and it's the two people that are winning on the final day. And the question is it valid? I've had some players each of the last 3 years say that tee is too far back. You can't go for the green. It's a boring four. And we've got this year, we had 20% in the final round actually get the birdie, which means that probably 40% were going for the birdie. And I wanted to ask the question, is it valid to design a tee pad for two players?
I think before I can answer that, the question, and we had this discussion with Nate Sexton, Nate Doss, and myself, which is primarily them, but what is the perfect hole distribution? What is the perfect score distribution for a hole? Like, what is golf or disc golf? What do we consider good scoring distribution? Is that 25%, birdie, 25% bogey and worse, and then a 50% in the middle. Like, we genuinely don't know. Is there a consensus on what good scoring distribution should be for a good disc golf hole? Because then that I need to know that to answer your question of...
I don't think you do, Terry. And the reason is because on an average hole, yeah, you're going to want to have 20 to 40% birdies, and you're going to want to have 20 to 40% bogeys, and then some number in between, whatever, you know, all the rest are pars. You're going to want to have a nice variety there. So some of them you'll have 20% birdies, and some of them you have 40% birdies, and that's an okay range. Maybe even up to 50% if you have like a deuce or die kind of hole, like maybe 15 at Maple Hill. But when you get down to the last hole, then I feel like the number of birdies should be much smaller. You don't want to, in my opinion, you don't want the last hole to be a deuce or die. That would be silly, because you've got the two best players at this event who are going to be elite level players who are playing hot, playing an easy hole. They're just going to both birdie. That's silly. So I think you need to challenge them. You need to say, okay, you guys have stepped up for 71 holes and you are the two men, period. Here you go. This is the hole. It is designed specifically for you in this situation. And that's how I view hole 18. Is in this case, it was designed entirely for Linus and Corey. And that was it. Simon, it was designed for Simon as well, but he had already finished, so it was, he had a different choice. He had a different gamesmanship going on.
Yeah, but it's not designed for them if Simon's in the clubhouse with a 3-stroke lead, then the hole obviously is irrelevant.
Correct.
You know,
yeah,
so
in that case, it doesn't matter how you design 18.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously 18 only matters if there's a 1 or 2 stroke difference. So at that point.
I mean, I think I can understand the player's complaint, because I would have to look at who birdied the hole. I mean, because so it feels
absolutely,
like
absolutely it's a big hole.
You need a very good drive and a pretty good forehand, probably. Now, we can see some people get on with backhands, but primarily most players are taking a forehand at that second shot, depending on how close you are. I think Corey was close enough where he maybe could have taken a backhand at it, because he was like 160 out. Mm-hmm. But that's still a funny angle. You're much more reliable with a forehand as far as the way the disc bends, but... I mean, I guess I could see a complaint as far as how many people take fours, because there are a lot, but I don't know. I like the hole personally. I think that in an age when our players are throwing further and further, it's going, I don't necessarily know if we need to back it up more, but I mean, Corey had a perfect drive and was 160 feet out.
The argument, there's nobody saying we should back it up more.
No.
people are saying, let's move it back up to the current blue pad. Where Corey Ellis and Gannon Burr and all the guys in the $1 million shot are going to throw it up to the wall and have an 80-foot look at eagle.
But you know, again, those are still the elite distance throwers. Everyone else is going to be the 160 out where Corey is, and still have, you know, Corey was with the current pad, and still have a difficult approach getting on.
Correct. But who are you on hole 18? What are you trying to do? That's where I'm going.
Yeah.
And that's the question. Am I trying to separate 20th from 21st, or am I trying to separate first and second?
I mean, I like it, just as we say, it gives everybody a chance to make a decision on that particular hole.
I don't know if it, well, I don't feel like it gives your weakest arms even a,
I don't think
there's, they even have, right?
No,
there's, and I'm not saying it should, but let's face it, there's some arms out there that would have a hard time. I mean, they would have to throw beyond their perfect second shot to still find it, or no?
I guess it's 640 feet, play slightly uphill from that tee pad.
You throw it four. If four you can throw,
most of our pros can throw 400 feet, 450 feet,
yeah, I guess.
And that leaves you. Yeah,
it would require. Yeah, if you can throw 420 feet, it would require a very good second shot to get the birdie. Very low percentage, but if you're in that situation,
it gives
you got to go for it, and you have a chance.
Yeah,
and that's the goal.
Have you put any thought into Corey's decision? Like, I think everybody sits there and thinks at 160 feet, should he have gone for that for the win versus playing
for the
playoff? I agree. I think he kind of
I've given it no thought. It was a gimme. He had to go for it. It was a gimme decision, not a gimme shot.
Yeah. I mean, I can see the other way. I kind of agree with you. I think that if the playoff starts at 18, there's not a chance he's probably getting to that position again in the playoff.
Or maybe more importantly, where is he going to find an advantage in the playoff against Simon Lizotte, right? Because they're going to 18. They're both going to have to match shot for shot and just replay that hole again.
They're going to play 18 and then one was the thought, right?
Yeah.
Right.
18. Then I mean, arguably, you could say Simon doesn't have a strong forehand right now. Is Simon going to go for that? Going to go for that green? I don't believe he went for it most. You know, does Corey, and granted, is Corey even thinking about this? But this is all hindsight 2020 stuff. Corey being one of the best circle two putters in our game, did it make more sense for him to lay it up to the drop zone area where it used to be the drop zone? I think it's OB now, and give himself a 60 footer for the win versus giving himself a 60 footer for the push. I can understand both scenarios, whether or not he should or shouldn't. I could agree with, I don't think there's a wrong decision. Honestly, had he gone for that 60 footer for a putt to win it, I could look at that and go, well, yeah, he's the best circle two putter we have in the sport, but giving yourself an opportunity to win it.
Corey is one of the players that I personally don't know very well. And so I can't speak to his game or what he was thinking. I believe if he went and stood in that spot, 9 times out of 10, he's going to throw that on the green. And I think he's, I would take that bet.
I don't know if it'd be 9. I mean, I think he's getting there 7.
I think 8.
All right. But I mean, in general, it's a higher percentage that he's making it on than he's not, because, there's a ton of pressure.
Absolutely, but I would take an 8 out of 10 chance to avoid a playoff and win outright right now. I'm going to take that every time.
Mm-hmm.
And having said that, there is a ton of pressure. I will tell us a wonderful story. This is one of my favorite stories because it ends with me winning.
spoilers, bro! Damn you, Steve, you're not learning.
Back in the day. The first NEFA tournament that I ever won, I had a 2-stroke lead going on the final hole, and I had about a 25-foot putt with water behind. And the smart play is to lay it up. And I said, you know what? Screw all these people. I want to just bang this thing home, and I'm gonna win this tournament. And my arm was lead, and I was so nervous. And I putt that thing as hard as I can. I made it about 18 feet. And the guy who I had a two-stroke advantage on said smart play, and I hit my 7-footer and I made it in. But he didn't know I was throwing that disc as hard as I could, and it didn't go anywhere. So pressure is a real thing, and it sometimes it bites.
Yeah, sometimes it bites you.
Sometimes it buys you frozen dinners. You there?
He's here.
Yeah, you're back. You were just saying pressure is a real thing, and sometimes it bites you.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it came down to. And then we saw, Simon waiting for 20 to 30 minutes in the scoring room. We were lucky enough to have a camera watching him and Paul interact, and kind of a little nervous energy in there, but it was.
So one of the things that I love about the spectators at Maple Hill is if Corey had thrown that on the green, or if Linus had gotten the birdie, it didn't, either one, But if they had gotten the birdie and gotten the win, the fans would have erupted. They would have loved it. Yes, Simon is the hometown favorite. Yes, in their heart of hearts, people probably wanted Simon to win. But if Corey hits that, I'm getting goosebumps right now because I could feel the electricity when that shot was being made. And if that shot went on, there was going to be a ridiculous eruption. People want to see success, especially the Maple Hill spectators. And it was, I believe Simon wanted him to throw that on. Like everybody wanted that shot to go on, and everybody wanted to cheer for that success. When it didn't happen, they were equally, potentially even more, but equally as excited to cheer for Simon coming out of the scoring shed and being crowned champion. But it's nice knowing that no matter how it went down, there wasn't going to be silence. It was like people. Simon's the hometown champion, hometown hero, but if Corey beats him, we are cheering our heads off for Corey.
Yeah, and even as Johnny just had the final round pulled up, I look at Simon's scorecard. Is that the final round?
This is the third and final round.
Yeah. You look at Simon's scorecard, and what I find kind of crazy is that he doesn't birdie. Yeah, of course, he gets 11 birdies out there. Very impressive. But he doesn't get hole 15, and he doesn't get hole 5. Two of the easier holes on the course. Now, obviously, he picked up some other bonuses in there. I think I kind of consider 13 a little bit of a bonus. 16 is definitely a bonus. But it's interesting to look at a scorecard like that to see him go 18 under in the last two rounds to shoot two over. And as the UDisc probability chart had him going into Sunday morning, they had him as a 3%, probable chance of winning. So again, I'll go back to the numbers. As much as I know you love numbers, what do you think of the one of the other new additions to UDisc and the probability chart? And how much stock should someone like me as a commentator put into those?
I would put a decent amount of stock into them. I think they add to the depth of the story significantly. When Simon is at 3% to start the round and through six holes, you notice it's bumped up to 18%. I think that's a really fun story. I personally think that's a very fun story. That win percentage chance, I look at that thing in football games. I look at that in baseball games. It's a really fun stat to look at. It has, some, I guess, but it has no impact on what actually is going to happen. It's just predictive. But we're looking at one data point. You're rolling a 100 sided die. It could come up a one. You never know. Mm-hmm. We're doing one event, and the win percentage doesn't have any impact on that one event, but I think it helps build the story. And obviously most times that 3% isn't going to pay off, but in this one case, you don't have any idea.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible. I don't even know if I looked or saw Simon's percentage that morning, and it was pointed out later that it had started at 3%. And, obviously that's why we play the game, right? That's why. All the fantasy numbers, all the stats don't matter.
Right. One interesting thing about the percentages, in my opinion, as Linus and Corey were teeing off on 18, they on the DGN broadcast, it actually had the percentages in the bottom right. And it had Simon at 35. I think Corey was 33 and Linus was 32% chance of winning. And I thought, that's amazing. Because I'm assuming that they're calculating how they normally do on 18. There's all sorts of stats. I don't know if they throw pressure or stress in that statistic, but I never would have given Simon the nod on that. You got two big arms who, if either of them birdie, he doesn't win. There's one of them. I would have given both of them a 40% chance and given Simon a 20% chance. But clearly they. Well, who knows what the odds should have been? Who knows how it would play out? But I was surprised to see that Simon was the favorite on the tee. And I'll go ahead and say that after the drives, the percentages didn't change. So it isn't shot by shot; it's hole by hole.
It is. They've got a whole article where they're basically simulating it like 20,000 or 30,000 times each for the hole or holes that are like it, similar distance. And you can look at the previous rounds and see that Corey and Linus, none of them birdied 18, not any round.
Oh, wow.
So that's probably why the percentages were what they were, is that they were less likely to birdie. And I guess if you're less likely to birdie, you're more likely to par, but there is the slight chance you're going to take a bogey, as unfortunately we saw with both of them.
So I'm going to say that stat didn't take into account the fact that it was the final hole and someone's going to push.
That's what I was just thinking, is like, clearly, you could have a great round going and you get to 18, you're just a little out of position and you're like, yeah, this is a no brainer. I'm laying this up and I'm going to get out of here today with a par and not sweat it, knowing, so yeah.
I mean, it can't take in every factor into account. I think it just looks a lot at previous scores and history and similarities. So, I mean, you put Paul Macbeth in that percentage, and I bet you he's at like 55% or 60% to win because he's birdied the hole a few times.
Yeah.
Right. Yep.
While we're at it, this just came to mind.
Come on, Terry.
Yep. Josh's birthday from UDisc, one of the co-founders.
Happy birthday, Josh.
Of UDisc. May or may not be out there listening. He should be doing much better things on his birthday. But I believe today, it was either today or yesterday, I believe it was today, is in fact Josh's birthday from UDisc. So happy birthday, Josh.
Real quick, I do just want to kind of go through some of the MPO. Simon Lizotte obviously wins in a non-playoff the Chase card.
Ah, I was waiting for post-production.
I have a question for you guys.
Yeah, go for it.
I believe Simon won. But regarding Josh's birthday, you said it might be yesterday. Do you mean Tuesday?
Well, for you.
It's still.
Where is he these days?
What time is it?
It's 11:41 your time.
Yeah, it's still only 11:41 your time.
Your time.
And he might be listening live because they watch live from time to time. Some of the UDisc fellers.
So it's still today.
It's still today, but I think it was, in fact, yesterday, if I recall. My brain, I travel. I believe it was yesterday. Either way, very recently, it was his birthday.
Second place, Corey
Ellis. Simon Lizotte won. Yep.
Okay.
Tied for third, Gannon Byrne, Paul Macbeth. Gannon obviously having that rough hole 14, kind of taking the five.
16?
He parred 16. He had double bogeyed 14.
Wait, didn't he kick OB on 16?
I'm sorry. I was looking at the wrong round.
In round two, he double bogeyed.
You're right. He double bogeyed 16 in the final round. I was looking at the wrong round.
It was round two, hole 14, that knocked him out of it.
It was. Had he not bogeyed? Yeah. I mean, that's the hole. If you think about it, 16, what's the difference between 16 in the final round and 14 in the other round? 14 is an easier hole than 16. So, yeah. And, hey.
Is that true?
I would think so.
He just blurts it out.
Yeah.
Well, let's look at the numbers, folks.
The way I look at it, 16.
Oh, man. Here we are doing math on the air. So 16 average, 0.09 above par on round three. 0.09 above par. So it played at 3.09, just barely above par. That's 16. And hole 14 played at negative 0.09.
Wow.
14, I mean, just based on the shot, 14 is an easier shot. You throw it off to the left, you end up in the woods. 90% of the time, you're laying it up in front of the basket and tapping in.
Like, here's the crazy part.
I feel
part.
Like there's some OB on 14.
There is, but you can easily avoid the OB if you play it really safe.
Terry, look at those stats for Friday.
What's crazy to me is 31%, 31% birdies on 14, and on 16, just 17%, but clearly on 16, if you're not birdieing, you're probably parring, so to speak.
Yeah.
On 14, if you're not birdieing, there's a good chance. I don't know.
No, I think scroll back down to 14 and 16 once. Yeah. 16, you've got a much higher bogey rate on 16 because it's bogey versus 14. Like your chance to bogey 16 is much greater than your chance to bogey 14.
See, and I, I,
I guess I just, maybe a lot more people are landing safely,
yeah,
bailing out,
yeah,
than finding it's, actual water. I would assume, correct, more people would be finding water.
No, I guess well, I think case. It's easier. Like, if I just imagine myself walking up to that hole, my thought is, keep it in bounds, dummy. Go left.
Yeah.
Like, whatever you do, yeah, don't go right. Throw something really stable. Hole 16, I walk up to that hole and go, ooh, that's awfully tight. That's a long tunnel. Like, I could,
I'm not hitting that no matter what I do.
Yeah, I could hit a tree and kick off any direction. And there's OB, depending on where you go.
Wow.
On 16.
So back on round one, Steve, to answer you, even though you probably,
yeah,
pulled it up.
I just looked.
14 played at 3.16. 16 played at 3.18.
Still harder.
So technically 14 played easier. And I guess since we're here, let's check round
two. And round two was 3.12 versus 3.15. It's
so hole 14 plays marginally, but razor thin, slightly easier than 16. So I guess the follow-up to that is, that obviously surprises you. Is that what you're telling us, Steve?
It does indeed. Okay. It's kind of like the Wisconsin electorate.
Yeah, me too. you're not wrong there. Tied for,
it's very, very close.
Yes. Ugh. Fifth place, Linus Karlsson, who obviously had that very, he was in a chance to win it going into 18. Had a
crazy,
he just shanked the drive, yeah, hits the tree on the left,
yeah,
and then goes for you have to at that point go for the something to get up there, hits the stump,
right,
on the roller, and at that point it was over for Linus. Tied for sixth place, a three-way tie with Kyle Klein, who we like didn't see all weekend. He kind of snuck up,
right,
from like a fourth card or something.
Mm-hmm.
Vaino Mäkelä and Ricky Wysocki. And then finally, we'll round out your top 10, Jake Hebenheimer and Matt Bell. That's it.
So I had a very good conversation with Vaino, who I had never met before also. And I walked up to, he was in the pro shop, and I walked up to him, shook his hand. I said, you're a very good disc golfer. And he said, thank you. And I said, let me know if there's anything about this course that you think we should improve. And he said, I guess you didn't see my blog where I said that this is the best course in the United States.
Damn.
And I said, thank you very much. And I said, Europe is not in the United States. And he said, that's correct.
He confirmed that. That's in the control room, we call Vaino the teapot because of his putting style. He stands there, he waits, and then he puts his hand on his back. And he lifts his hand out so he looks like a teapot. And all of us in the control room, I think maybe except for Mo chuckles, but we all go, I'm a little teapot. And then he putts every time. It's just, unless he's straddling, then it's a little different. Then he has to kind of put his hand on his hip. But if he's got a normal putt, a staggered putt, it always looks like he's just waiting to do, I'm a little teapot. So that's his nickname in the control room for everybody. That's,
yeah,
our inside scoop.
Do you believe what you're missing out on in the control room here, Steve?
I know it's not, it's way more fun with a lot of people.
I do believe it.
Which is why we don't stream the control room.
Yeah.
I've got this little camera.
So
here
did anybody comment on the hole 18? Should it be designed just for the top two guys or should it be designed for everybody?
I mean,
did anybody comment on that?
Not really. They were just talking about, well, some people do want it shorter because then they want more people going for it. And then I think they said that grows the sport. I lost the connection there, but yeah, somebody did mention that they just basically thinks it should be shorter.
Okay.
But then the Deacon H87 said, I like the idea of forcing the leaders to do something coming down the stretch. But if it's 50 feet closer, you force everyone to go for it because the upshot will be more than doable and drama ensues.
Well, 50 feet closer, Corey Ellis had a 116-foot shot, which is, I think we'd all agree, is 9 out of 10.
Yeah. I'll give you that.
No, that's a jump putt at that point.
For a lot of
somebody else says, hole 18 is perfect. People need to stop crying and learn how to golf, how golf should be played. It's not about an easy par four because those holes are bad. So
I find the term perfect funny because we have seen so many people be like, no, Maple Hill's perfect. And they said this 8 years ago.
I was going to say we've changed it every year.
And Maple Hill changes every single year. Mo and I had this discussion about hole four, which he has said has never changed.
Correct. Mm. That is true.
There's been Mandos or not.
Correct.
And then there's been sidewalls.
We did add a Mando.
Sidewalls.
And then the green changed. And then behind the basket changed whether or not you could go OB.
Exactly.
That holes four changed all the time.
I think his point was the pin position hasn't changed in hole four. But it's been
elevated. And the tee hasn't changed. And we didn't move any of the trees.
Correct. But it's, you know, we argue that these holes are perfect. You know, I didn't like the change on hole two.
Yeah, so talk about that. I was going to go there. With the rocks.
With the rock wall. I like the fact that players could go at it with a roller. And we did see Matt Bell still go with the roller and make it through the woods. So
So I thought you were talking about the change like 8 years ago when we moved the pin back.
No, I like that change.
Or the tee back. Like, we moved that back.
I didn't like the first change. I liked the second one. I definitely didn't like the third one, but this fourth one I don't like.
So talk to us about the rocks.
Sounds like a 2-2-1-1.
Well, you know, I'm just kidding. I have no clue. So
I know
the rocks on two.
So those were the rocks on two. So number one, did you notice that the fairway on hole 18 did not have any of those huge rocks on the upper corner near the drop zone?
No,
I didn't particularly notice that.
Those rocks are all gone.
Where'd they go?
That was hole
Did they get
two.
Up and rock away?
So we had a guy come with a huge claw, and I actually asked him, I said, how heavy is that rock? And I said, is that about 2,000 pounds? He said, that's 8,000 pounds. And I said, how do you know that? And he said, because my vehicle can lift 8,000 pounds. And this is right on the edge. Like, he was like, as he lifted it up, like the back end comes up and he's got a like, it was very exciting.
Another insurance policy was written before that one.
FOIA insurance. So we moved, I needed somewhere to put all those rocks. And I've always wanted the green of hole two to be flat. And so those rocks are the beginning of that green becoming flat.
Okay.
So over time, we will continue to build up that wall, and then it'll fill in. And this is probably a 5-year plan. But then that'll fill in with dirt, and we'll put grass on it. And then when you land in the creek, you'll have a 5-foot wall in front of you. You've got to either get up on the green, or you've got a really hard shot at the birdie.
Okay. So, I mean, the thought was that you just did that to take away the roller option.
No, not at all. I don't care about rollers. Yeah.
All right.
This had nothing to do with rollers. This was a long-term plan towards making that green beautiful.
Yeah, you should have told me all this like a week ago.
Would have been helpful on the broadcast.
Did you not do your research?
Did you not call Steve Dodge a week before and just have a good talk about the changes? I mean, that's your job as a commentator. What are you doing in your off time?
I was practicing my 400-foot hole-in-one $25 shot that I had lined up. Not quite the same. Okay. So no other significant change. Oh, there is another significant change that I don't feel like was the case last year. Well, it was much lower and less pronounced, in my opinion, in that there's a backstop. There's a wall on the back of eight. And why people that's inbounds. I think that's maybe the most crucial part. That's inbounds. Yes. We should never see a person come up short. Like, I get it. You're trying to get it as close to the basket as possible.
Oh, no.
But you should never come up short. Is that right?
That is not right.
You're wrong.
You can scoot underneath that wall.
Hmm. Really? There's a space in there?
There's big spaces.
Good.
Yeah. Could I fit there?
I don't know if...
Not that big.
I don't know if they... Could you fit there? Yeah, easy.
We heard a bunch of bank shots. We heard it hitting the wall, skipping up, hit the wall, maybe on the fly once or twice. Like, I didn't realize there was a space underneath the wall. So you're saying you could land,
yeah,
and you could, if you're just coming in slow enough, you could just scoot right out underneath the backside of the wall.
Scoot is the right word. Scoot.
Yeah, because you're not really skipping at that point. You're sliding.
You might
boot scooting.
Boogie
underneath it. Okay.
Yeah, so you want to land it on that green. You do not want to rely on that wall.
Okay.
Relying on that wall is you're hoping to get lucky.
It's a fool's errand, Terry.
So Adam, who I think was out there on 8, says 8's wall should go all the way to the ground. We talked about putting umbrellas to stop the disc from going OB. I'm just reading from what the chat says. But Adam,
they tried that last week. It didn't work so well.
But so you're saying by design, it does not go all the way to the bottom. Now, and is that wall out there permanently? Like if I went out there in a month, will that wall still be there?
So yes, it will still be there. I think that I agree with Adam. And I think that we might build that wall all the way to the ground.
Oh.
We did not build it all the way to the ground yet, because we're not 100% sure on that. But surprisingly, I haven't heard any pushback from the players about the wall not going all the way down.
If it goes all the way to the ground, aren't we just going to see players attack it?
Yeah.
I don't like that.
So, but the reason that wall was built in the first place is the Pro Tour has a really good policy, which is that the course assets, like the walls that they build on the course, the advertising walls, cannot be OB walls. Yep. And I think that's a good policy because those are just built the week before. It's not the way the course is, any course is normally played.
We've seen things kick them and move them and they change throughout the weekend. Yeah.
So wherever those walls are, if there's OB near them, the OB is, you know, a yard or a meter off of it or so. And unless the wall is permanent, they don't want to allow advertising walls to be OB. And so I said, well, I want a permanent wall there then, because that the goal of that wall is to be the OB, and logicking through this, therefore it should, I agree with Adam again, it should go all the way to the ground, but right now it does not go all the way to the ground. So your thought about people just running that thing nice and hard and low is not correct yet.
Well, I guess I just generally mean if it's coming in hot, there's a certain degree in which it may skip up and just bank right off the wall, you know.
Yeah, that's true. I saw this. You shouldn't be short. There's water there.
Yeah.
I saw this skip up over the wall. That can definitely happen. I didn't see anything do the Johnny V boot scoot. Mm.
Okay. So maybe one of the, as we start to wrap up here, because I think we could go all day. Of course, the Tour Points champion, you had the MVP Open champions crowned, obviously. And then we had the Tour Points.
I'm sorry the name's so long for you, Terry.
I know.
you barreled through it.
Well, I'm thinking the Maple Hill Open. Yeah. I finally have it down, kind of. So
kind of.
We then also see that this year, final event on the Pro Tour, which again feels weird to say, well, it's the final event of, it's not the regular season, it's the final playoff event, but yet we go into a championship. But anyway, when you originally had designed the Pro Tour Championship to be the culminating event, there's, I think since day one, and I think the internet proved it yet again today, since day one, there's been a little confusion about what those titles are and what they mean. As in, there's a final event winner at the Pro Tour Championship, but there's also an overall points leader. And I know I'm saying correct those, and it doesn't sound too hard, but to a lot of people, it's confusing, and I understand that. What was your thought process?
It's a season.
There?
It's a season. There's a season champ, and there's a Super Bowl champ. or the Tour Championship champion. So there's two distinct champions. My brother's a big fan of soccer, mm-hmm. and I learn a lot from his enjoyment of the game, and I'm under the impression that and soccer buffs can correct me if I have heard him wrong, but I'm under the impression that there is someone who has the best record, and that is the season champion. Mm. And then they have the playoffs, and there is the playoff, the playoff champion, or the person who wins the cup, as it were. But the season champion is recognized as a significant victory, as well as the overall the winner of the playoff. And so, in my opinion, the season champion should be exalted, as well as the person who wins the finals.
Well, this is the Ricky discussion.
To some degree, and I wasn't necessarily just trying to dig into what Ricky has been talking about, but just in general, I was looking for your design or your thought process to why, because it rightfully so, it confuses a ton of people when it comes down to, you won the Disc Golf Pro Tour
points,
title, championship. Like,
see, you're the season champion.
Yeah, you're the points champion. You're not necessarily necessarily the Pro Tour championship champion.
I know.
I would say that the person with the most points is the season champion.
Yeah,
calling it the points champion, that sounds silly, but to me, I would say they're the season champion. Not that it matters very much, but. Yeah. So I think that those are both things that are worth celebrating.
I agree.
Oh, having said that, Simon won 4 Pro Tour events and got 6th place. And it makes me think maybe 1st place should get some more points. I know that Simon is very inconsistent. He what he said was, I get 1st or 30th. So it's rewarding consistency over victories, but it feels like maybe victories should matter a little bit more in the season champion. But that's a decision for somebody else to discuss. But
Simon also played poorly, very poorly, at one of our playoff events at GMC, where he earned not very many points, so to speak, and those can't be dropped. Those are automatically.
Oh, that's right.
So there's a premium to playing well the last 2 events.
And he played poorly at Champions Cup, which is a major where you get like point and a half or double points. So maybe it is
about right then.
Yeah, I mean, if we were just
right,
if we were just talking DGPT events, then I think there's definitely discussion. I would have to look, and I'm not going to ever, at how he did without the majors. But correct, His major count was not good. He did not play well at the majors, from what I gather.
Yeah.
And UDisc, if you're listening,
I know what you're going to say.
Give me a left and right scroll bar. And if you don't mind, I would kind of like it if the most recent event was first. That's iffy, though. I might be unique there. But give me a left and right scroll bar in the standings.
Do you know what UDisc needs?
More suggestions from us.
That's Yahoo's. You know what you should do? Yeah. My favorite words in disc golf after I gave them to Steve earlier.
When you're looking at the standings, because you get your best, I don't even know what it is, 8 Elite Series and your best 3 Silver Series and all of the majors, right?
Something like that, yeah.
So I feel like they need to have something that indicates how many of those events they have. Like, if you're looking at this, like, Kristen's on top and Paige is 2nd. But it's possible that, like, if Paige has only played 7 Elite Series and Kristen's played 8, then the next one for Kristen is actually a replacement, and the next one for Paige is an addition. And I think that's an important thing to notate, because and obviously this isn't the way it actually is, but well, in that case, Paige would actually have a significant advantage after the points of the next event, because they're being added as opposed to replaced. So
yeah, I think those
when
are,
I look at yeah.
I was just gonna say I think those are all really I agree and I think it would be great. I think it's there's something to the programming of Elite Series versus Silver Series and then the majors, all of them having the different point totals and then which one are they playing in or not versus which ones get dropped. Yeah, it's crazy. And there's a good reason why within the broadcast booth we have very much said, like, we're not getting into these scenarios of, well, if so-and-so does this and so-and-so does that, but he get, like, I'm not about to try and do that math. If somebody really smart, you know, writes up that code and those equations, great, I'll read them, but I'm not about to try and figure it out because they're impossible.
It is very hard to figure out. And sometimes on my screen, I'll just put, like, little stickers on there, but then when I scroll, the stickers don't go up and down with it. And
can like, you just fix that touch screen?
You need a touch screen monitor. That'll fix it.
But the stickers are still just on there.
Yeah. Well, not if it's touch screen.
You use Microsoft Post-it? Maybe. I don't know.
Have you talked to your friend Clippy with Microsoft?
Are you trying to write a resume? Yes.
I am now, damn it. With all the dumb shit I did today. Anyway. Flipping back real quick, of course, Disc Golf Pro Tour wrapping up with then Kristen Tatar, the first person not named, Pierce or Allen or Holcomb to have won this and clearly just destroying everybody in the last few events specifically, in addition to playing well throughout the year, but just really blazing past everybody in the last few events. What does that say for disc golf to have a woman from Estonia as our season champion on the Disc Golf Pro Tour? What does that say about the Pro Tour and about disc golf in general?
So this was the seventh Pro Tour season. It's really, really exciting to watch the Pro Tour come into its own. Back in the early days, I did an interview before the MVP Open, and we talked about back in the early days when people were like, would you rather win an NT or win a Pro Tour? And obviously in 16, it was an NT, and in 17, it was probably an NT, and in 18, maybe it was we had some parity, and in 19, it was a Pro Tour. The Pro Tour has, in my opinion, gone through its youth and has started its life as an adult. And I think Kristen is a representation of that. We've successfully gotten large enough so that the best players in Europe will come over and compete. And hopefully next year, 2023, we will have a whole cadre of Europeans over here competing for titles on the men's and women's side. And if the Pro Tour was a person, I think we've gotten to be about 18 or 19 years old. We're still going to make plenty of mistakes, but we've got a lot of energy and a lot of excitement, and we're just driving forward. And I'm ridiculously excited. It's so much fun. One of my favorite things to do is to sit down with Jesse on the couch and watch TGN and listen to Terry and listen to Nate Doss and listen to Nate Sexton and all the crew. And it brings me endless joy. And I'm really excited to watch this continue to bloom and be ridiculously exciting pretty much week in and week out. I don't know how the players do it. I don't know how you guys do it. I got to witness how they set up the courses, and they're becoming a machine. They know what they're doing, and the future looks very bright for the Pro Tour. I'm excited.
What would you say is next? Like what is either needed or is just or what will just come naturally, or what's needed, or where does the bar get raised next? In terms of
need,
yeah. I mean, what would be on your, whether it's a wish list or a vision?
What percentage
from day one?
What percentage of people have cable television? needed. I don't know what's needed. We have DGN, and I can, if I'm a PDGA member, so I can pay $6 a month, something like that, and watch all the disc golf that I want. I think over time, the broadcast will continue to improve. I can't imagine it continuing to improve at the rate that it has been improving. Back 4 years ago, 2018, we were happy to cover the lead card. We spliced in the women. We had to have ads at certain times because people walk down fairways. Like, it was a very structured program because we had three cameras, or maybe two. Like, it was, and now I clearly there's at least four, maybe six cameras out there. I can't see it getting eight cameras.
Eight cameras if you include the commentator, which kind of counts as a camera, but there's usually seven. There's usually three on the lead, two on the chase, one as a roamer. Sometimes we have the, I think it's called an FX6, which is like our slow-mo cam, or a drone, depending on what's going on. And then the commentator technically takes up a camera slot.
Eight cameras. That is that is very, very exciting. I remember, you're right. We always had cameras on the commentators because we never knew what's going on the course. Just cut to the commentators. We showed them a lot more back in the day.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we did.
The petitions are running wild to get back. More to the booth. No, they're not.
More to the booth. Yeah. Power to the Terry. What do we need? I don't know what we need. I'm not the man. I'm content with where we are. This is exactly what I wanted. And obviously the next step is to get on broadcast television. But I'm not in any hurry. I think it's important to keep building our foundation. And in my opinion, let them come to us. We don't need to go to them. We're good where we are. The longer it takes for us to get on broadcast television, the bigger our base is, and the more strength we have in negotiations with broadcast television. So I'd say take our time. Don't be in a rush to take the next step, because it's a really big step.
Do you, in speaking of big steps, do you feel like there's a world where FPOs and MPOs are, I'll call them a separate tour, but maybe that's not the exact phrasing, but they're either at different parks or different weekends or whatever the case may be. Do you see them either splitting, or do you see, or any other vision? Like, do you see a world where, hey, our FPO field, because it continues to grow or wants to grow, and we have 80 women at every event. Right now we have 40 to 50, sometimes could be 60, 70, or 80. Do you see FPO either needing or being viable to have FPO have a different tour? Or separated, maybe is a better word.
I remember 3 or 4 years ago talking with a lot of the women on tour, and asking them, at what rate should we grow the women's side of the women's side of the of these events? So at the time it was 140 men and 24 women, and now it's 120 men and 60 women. And should we just try to get down to 90 and 90 and call it, or like, what's the right thing to do, and how fast do you do that? These are really, really good questions. It feels to me, I have nothing to do with the management of the Pro Tour. I have nothing to do with any of the decision making. That we should make that very, very clear.
Neither do we, so that's good.
But, yeah. It's along for the ride.
But it feels to me that the women are not quite ready to go out on their own. And I feel like the draw of having the women eyeballs and the men eyeballs all in one bucket encourages larger non-endemic partners to come on board. If they were split, I think we'd lose some of that opportunity. Having said that, at some point, hopefully it'll be obvious that it needs to happen. I always said that I don't want to hire shuttle drivers until it's obvious it has to happen. This year, it's now obvious. So I suspect the same thing is going to happen with the women. It will become obvious when that split needs to happen. Someone will have seen it a year earlier and someone might not quite see it, but for the powers that be, it'll be obvious. I would just say that I hope that they stay in the same area, town, region. I would be sad if the men were playing Maple Hill and the women were playing De La Viega. Like that would make me sad because I like the energy that comes to a town when we're all together. Who knows? I'm an old idiot, so who knows?
You know, I mean, I just think of the logistics of running two separate tours and what needs to happen as far as, I mean, imagine having to run two Maple Hills or MVP Opens or, you know, that because, you know, we're going to want one for FPO and one for MPO. And if they're not the same time, you're doubling your resources, twice the volunteers. You've got parking things again, like expenses and...
If we can stay as a playoff event with a smaller field, then maybe at the playoff event that the men and women can be together and that can be a celebration.
Sure.
But I get your point. Yeah. And if you're going to you're going to Akron, Ohio, the tour has a stop there, and I just picked that out of the air. I don't know anything. But then the men play at Akron A and the women play at Akron B, and hopefully they're in my opinion they should all. I'd love us all to be together. If this ever happened, yeah, I'd want to make sure that there can be a players' party where everybody's together.
Yeah, I don't think. Gosh, I kind of see this our growth as starting. I don't say plateauing, but it's not growing at the rate it was, and I don't see us needing to split tours. 7-10 years at best.
I was going to say six to eight was my guess.
Like if we continue at a decent growth rate, like we could plateau off, we could spike again. I don't know why we would or anything like that. Anything is possible, but I just think of all the logistics of broadcast and tour and fundraising and things like that of what would have to happen, and it's mind blowing to me. So.
Yeah. Well, it's mind blowing to me. They've got two trailers now leapfrogging each other, setting up like this. We started setting up the course before GMC began. Mm-hmm. And I guess it was Friday during GMC. But I was so excited that we could do that. And they do so much work. We have a lot of staff to help. But the work that the Pro Tour puts in is phenomenal. They do a great job.
Is there, for many years, Maple Hill had happened before GMC. This year, obviously, happening after. Do we feel like that's going to be a constant conversation, or is this new? Is that just timing because of certain things that need to happen up at GMC with Fall Fest? Like, what's that conversation like? And do you see, obviously, next year throws things out the window, being that the World Championships are going to be taking place there in early September. But
the schedule's about to be announced, by the way.
Oh. Well, so again, next year's already an anomaly, but
sometime this week.
In
future years, though, is there something to be said about you being the final playoff season, event? Is that something you're hoping to lock in?
I think it was like 2005 or 6 or 7 when we became an NT for the first time, and from the very beginning, I have always said I will hold my event in April and I will hold my event in September, whatever works best for the schedule. I feel like the tour is larger than any particular event. Well, obviously that's true. But and so I'm more than happy to have the MVP open at whatever time works best for the tour. If the tour decides, hey, we want to be in the Northeast in the summer because it's nice and cool. That's great. We'll be happy to do that. If they decide that they want to have the playoffs on the West Coast, I'm fine with that too. Okay. When it comes to when we are, I'm a team player. We're very honored to be a playoff event this first time that they had playoff events. I look forward to seeing what the playoff events develop into so that they have maybe a little special flair to them. Maybe the winner of a playoff event gets an extra bye in the tour championship or something. I don't have any idea what could develop so that it's a little more special. But we're happy to be whenever. We just look forward to being a part of the Pro Tour for a long time.
Okay.
It would be really interesting to see the tour path change, almost reverse the way we are. Just have Vegas towards the end of the year, 1 year, and then Kansas, DDO isn't in April or May. It's in August, which August in Kansas sounds miserable, but just in general, but nobody wants to be in Vegas in, July. So, but just, see the West Coast swing towards the end of the season and start over on the East Coast. It would be fun to kind of reverse course once in a great while, but I understand logistically.
I wouldn't reverse course because it's fun.
No, it has to have a logistic reason.
Yeah. I would look at, and I'm confident that Jeff Spring and the Pro Tour look at this holistically and say, let's look forward 3 or 4 years and where do we need to be? They're starting to develop the wraparound season. So they want to continue to develop that. And then what does that mean for the Southeast? What does that mean for the Northeast? What does that mean for Europe? What does that mean for South America, Mexico? What does that mean for Japan? Like there's lots of implications here. And I suspect that Jeff is looking at this whole thing and crew are looking at this whole thing with their eye on the entire basket. And I'm happy to shift wherever needs be to make the tour work as good as it can work. And I feel like that's the way every TD on the tour feels, is the tour succeeds and we succeed.
Well, I'm not all that smart, but I'm guessing you're going to be 2 weeks after Worlds wraps up next year. Can't imagine you'd be the week after.
No, they would have they would have a week break.
But who knows? You must know when you are next year. Right, Steve? Maybe.
What?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Hello?
I'm going to end with this. I have a secret but mildly clever idea that I'm going to text you tonight that you have to give me first access to, and then you'll take it and run with it on your own. But I've got a great sponsorship idea.
Does it involve waking me up?
Yeah. So we'll share that quickly. I had asked Steve yesterday about being on the show. He eventually I got a yes after some, cryptic messaging. Eventually I get a yes. And then tonight, I send him the link, as we do for all of our guests, a little link to connect to. And then after about 5 minutes went by, I realized that it was 9:45 East Coast time. And I also just took a wild stab that Steve either forgot and or just flat out went to bed. And so thankfully, I called him, and in his most sleepy voice, hey, woke up. So that's your official pass. Some people were saying, hey, all this blazer talk, where's the suit coat or the blazer? And I said, to be fair, he just got up 4 minutes ago before joining us on the show. Yeah. So
he's lucky to have a shirt. And I would encourage people, now that they know that, go back and look at the beginning of this. And I'm just like, I don't have any idea what I'm talking about at the beginning of this. I still don't, but but at the beginning it was maybe a little worse.
I'm just going to derail this completely. My only question is that an original Commodore 64 back there?
Yes.
Okay. I know they did a repop version of it a couple of years ago, but
so let's close this out on a strong note, Jerry. And
as opposed to the shitty way I was going to do it. Yeah, go for it.
So Jesse's the one that woke me up. Like, she's like, your phone's ringing. I was like, what? What's going on? It felt like it was ringing for hours. Uh-huh. But so, yeah, one of the fun things that happened because the tour came here when it did, is we kind of made my office into something real. And so we have here, this is my original version of Premiere.
Adobe. Yeah, Premiere.
Adobe. Yeah, the Premiere, the whole production suite. That's what it says right there. And that's what I used to mix the 2004 MSDGC DVD and all the other ones.
Nice.
Here's the old biddies. These are the prototypes of our games that are coming out Kickstarter this fall. There's my original house in 2003. And then this is the 2003 PDGA course guide that has all sorts of notes about the 150 courses we played before we built Maple Hill. I went around the country and played some of the best courses. And then here's my collection of trading cards. I don't know if you can see those.
Yeah.
Some of those are pretty valuable now, yeah, Steve.
Some of those are worth a lot of money.
So you got Ricky and Katrina and Paul, and you got all the champion, the course events, the event things. And then look at this funny one.
Wow.
You see that one?
Is that a unique one?
There it is.
A Steve Dodge card?
Is that a one of one?
That's right.
Yeah, you're almost got it.
Whatever. Yeah. And then the Commodore 64, and then the year one Silly Pints. Yeah. So all the good stuff in that cabinet right there. Oh, yes. And you guys might recognize this, the very first Disc Golf Pro Tour computer.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. I do remember that.
Yeah. That thing really hauled, as they would say.
Oh, it's a Chromebook.
Yeah.
Because we had $8
footage off a free program on using a Chromebook. Chromebook. Well, yeah.
I think it was called Wii Video.
Yeah.
Made a lot of the first videos for that.
Nailed it. Well,
that's where the salmon commercial came from.
Yes, it is. And I want to say thank you to the 12 people that signed up to get salmon delivered to their door.
Hopefully they enjoyed it.
That's what kept the tour rolling. All right, buddy. Well, we will let you go. We appreciate you. We appreciate Jesse for waking you up so that you could fulfill your obligation of joining us tonight. And of course, the entire world appreciates. If they don't appreciate what you've done and will continue to do, then they're idiots. And
we'll keep reminding them.
We will keep reminding them because we largely wouldn't be where we are if it weren't for you and your vision. And we appreciate the heck out of it.
I am always willing to try things, and the Pro Tour is one of those things. And we had a lot of love and heart and push and people working together and trusting in the dream and willing to literally work for nothing. And we successfully built it to a point where enough people cared about it that somebody thought it was worth saving. So, yeah, we did a lot of good work. We got lucky sometimes, got unlucky sometimes, I'm truly blessed to be in the position I'm in. I found Jesse. My daughters are growing up great, and I live at Maple Hill. I mean, life is pretty good, and I thank everybody for helping me get here.
Well, like I said, the entire disc golf world, ourselves included, owe you an unfathomable amount of gratitude, and we appreciate you for your vision, your love, and your heart and soul and compassion, everything that you have given to disc golf to put us where we all are. So we love you, buddy. You're welcome here anytime, even when you're not running a disc golf pro tour major playoff event or whatever. You're welcome here anytime to join us, even if you got to pitch some of your new board games or whatever you're doing. But anytime, you're always welcome. Thank you. Hopefully we'll talk to you again sooner than later, buddy.
Good night, friends.
Good night.
Good night, buddy. Special thanks to Steve Dodge for joining the show tonight. We know it's late over on the East Coast, and I'm sure he's tired after an exhausting week. I know he's got a big staff, but he still puts a lot of it on his shoulders, and it's good to be Steve.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Yeah. And can't say it enough. All right.
I want to touch on one other, I don't know, disc golf related item quickly that I saw today. If it hasn't been said enough already, of course, congratulations, Ricky Wysocki, your season tour champion, along with Kristen Tatar winning it on the FPO side. Congrats to both of them. And then, of course, congrats to Natalie Ryan for winning, and congrats to Simon Lazat. So if that wasn't obvious enough throughout the day, we thank you guys. Aaron says, I still have beef with Steve, and that couldn't be any more incorrect.
Have beef with him?
Yeah, never.
I mean, would you have steak with him? Maybe not beef.
I'd have chicken, or he'd mix me up some peanut butter sandwiches like we were once eating on the tour. And
Yeah.
So, the other quick thing that I wanted to talk about that I saw on the internets just today, so it's probably
fake.
Old news. Yeah.
It's probably fake.
We saw that it was pretty cool that they put up an official marker and tee pad, and I think I don't know if time capsule is quite the right word.
No, they did actually do a capsule underneath of the tee pad.
So all of that for James Conrad and the holy shot out there at the course, out there at the fort. So I saw it earlier today, and I wanted to make mention of it. I thought that was pretty cool that they're, you know, permanently commemorating that incredible
the holy shot. So you can try to recreate it. Yeah. You can go to the tee pad and throw it yourself. And
too bad you didn't have even that's more favorable for you. Not only don't you have thousands of people watching,
you have a tee pad.
You have an actual tee pad. The question is, and I did see it, but I didn't inspect it for too long. It doesn't look like a James Conrad approved tee pad. It needed to be about three times longer.
Hopefully it's as long as the amount of steps he took.
Okay,
because he didn't have a huge run up for that.
That's true.
Now, a normal tee pad for him would.
Exactly. So, that was pretty cool to see them out there. That was just posted, I think, earlier today. I don't know. Is there anything else actual golf related that needs to get covered before we close out, head to an after show? I know that was pretty long, our longest probably interview of the year, which seems very fitting and appropriate.
Very appropriate. I don't even know if I'm going to bother. Last week for Ricky's interview, I cut out just the interview and I uploaded it to our website or uploaded it to YouTube. I don't know. Let's bother doing it with Steve Dodge because it's been the whole show.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
So. All right. Well, then, unless you have something crucial that you feel like needs to get mentioned here in the regular show.
I don't, Terry.
I'll close out our regular show, and then we could start talking a little after show action if you'd really like.
Let's do it.
Well, we're going to thank Steve Dodge, our guest tonight. And thank you to, of course, everyone over on the Disc Golf Pro Tour and the Maple Hill side of things to pull off the event that they did. Clearly some very difficult decisions, but also just a ton of work to have everything go down the way that it did on that opening day, then to be able to still provide us all that coverage and action during the next 3 days, along with extra work in terms of pulling off the $1 million shot presented by East Coast Metal Roofing. Everybody on the ground doing so much extra work, and you don't think about it because they're just providing you the coverage, but it's just showing up on your screen is what I should say. But the guys that are putting in those extra long days to battle the winds and the rain as cameramen and as set up and takedown and the spotters, just everyone. And I can't imagine standing out in the rain for 8 hours or whatever, also trying to like park people. It's just such an effort that it takes. So for Steve Dodge, along with Johnny V, I'm Terry Miller, the Disc Golf Guy. That's been podcast 422. We're going to take a very quick break, and then we're going to come back with our after show. We have some giveaways and some other stuff to talk about. We'll see you then. You step inside the Smashbox.
Thank you to our $2 and above patrons. Your name is listed below in the credits. If you are interested in being listed as a producer in the Smashbox TV credits and supporting this and other fine podcasts, please visit patreon.com/smashboxtv.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.